No, it's
okay.
Working.
Yeah. It is approximately 1:30 on July 30th, and I'm in Carrie Cruz's office again. My name is Eric Treacle, and we're going to do a little bit of follow-up conversation. So thank you for your time again.
Of course.
And as you may have noticed, I actually did a little bit of background research and discovered there were things that you hadn't commented on in your past experience. And I was told that perhaps I should ask you about a few of these things.
Okay.
So, but I think one of the things that we left off with after we turned off the recorder last time was you started musing a bit more about your commitment ceremony.
Right.
And how that was a political activity for you.
Yes.
And so would you care to share with me what you mean about that?
Sure. So after we finished, I realized I hadn't covered that at all. I was like, oh, I should have talked about that. So my partner, Ellen, who I've been with for over 19 and a half years since we first started dating, we had a commitment ceremony in 1994. So we just had our 16th anniversary of that. And there were several things about that for me. You know, for one, it just sort of seemed like something to do at the time. There were very early activities along the lines of civil unions and domestic partnerships happening in various locations. And there was some talk about marriage and domestic partners. And actually, at the time, I hated the word partner. I hated the word commitment ceremony, or the phrase commitment ceremony. Commitment, it just all sounded too businesslike and too, I don't know, less loving. And so we both agreed that we wanted to do something. And we had some friends who had commitment ceremonies around that time. And we didn't like the phrase. At the time, politically, I was of a general mindset of, I don't really care if I can get married or have some sort of civil union. It doesn't matter to me what it's called, as long as there's sort of equal treatment, equal rights. A lot of my attitude about marriage is shaped by the fact that my father is now retired, but was a United Methodist minister. He was a United Methodist minister during a very liberal, active time in that church. He actually got involved in the church due to issues around civil rights, and he's always been active in social justice issues around the church. So it's always been a very progressive, liberal church type of thing. I was no longer going to church myself or identifying as Christian in any way, but we've never had issues with that, and my father is that kind of liberal minister. Doesn't have problems with that. But partly it's due to the fact that I was raised in that progressive, liberal church environment and recognizing that everybody has different belief systems and there's no one right one. So that was the framework of the Christianity I grew up with anyway. But because he was a minister, he also obviously performed marriages for hundreds of people. And one thing I always knew that he always talked about, he never talked about marriage as a union before God or, you know, any of those types of things. One thing I knew was that there's the legal part of getting married and the ceremony part of getting married. And for him, they were very distinct things. And he said that as far as he was concerned, it didn't matter what people did in the ceremony part because they weren't married until he signed the paper. And that for whatever, you know, reason, the way our society has evolved, it's the minister signing the paper or a judge signing the paper, whatever, official. But ministers are all automatically officials who can make it a legal binding thing. And so I also grew up knowing about weddings that were done, and you know, this was late 60s, early 70s, where mm-hmm. people were jumping over brooms or, you know, just doing whatever, you know, tradition struck them as interesting. So he married a lot of hippies. So, you know, and hearing him say, it doesn't matter what they do, you know, that's not what makes you married. What makes you married is when I sign the paper. And so I also understood the legal aspect of marriage, interestingly enough, from a minister's perspective, and understood that it's actually a legal status and not a status that the church really has anything to do with. As I grew up, I also had friends who ended up using my father to officiate at their weddings, because they understood him to be a liberal minister who was very open about these things, and he could be trusted to run a ceremony that didn't mention God if they didn't want it to, and would appease their parents somehow because it would be a minister. So they found kind of this middle ground, like, oh, we can have a minister marry us and that'll make my parents happy, but we don't actually have to have a religious ceremony. So that's the framework I came from. So I understood the ceremony to be a thing unto itself. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to have a ceremony. My dad officiated, if you want to call it that, since there was nothing that made it official. But I called it, he was our MC. So he kind of ran the ceremony. You know, so I also knew that even though it didn't give us a status of being married, it was in and of itself a nice thing to do to bring people together and bring family and friends and publicly say in front of people you care about and who care about you that you're creating a life together with someone. So we went into it with that. Ellen is a little shy, not much into public statements or public speaking or that kind of thing. So, you know, we also didn't say vows in front of everybody. So we kind of had this ceremony saying we're, you know, making a commitment to each other and spending our lives together. But she and I went off on a bike ride in the morning to Picnic Point and said our vows privately. So we actually said vows. We sort of felt the need to say something to each other. But we didn't do that part publicly. And, you know, to some extent, at the time I also felt that, you know, even though I'd grown up with awareness of people doing all sorts of creative things at ceremonies, I was also kind of disappointed when I would go to straight couples' weddings and they would be so traditional. It's like, you can do anything you want, you know. And then I was also seeing really kind of cool creative things happening in commitment ceremonies between same-sex couples because they already have this, you know, it's not the traditional wedding frame of mind anyway. So I think there, I was noticing some more interesting things happening. And so, you know, but it was traditional in that we invited friends and family. Ellen's relationship with her family is very different than mine, and she did not involve her father at the time. Her mother had already passed away, and she was just not choosing to go there with her dad. She did invite her siblings, and two of her sisters came from New York to the ceremony. And, you know, my feeling was, you know, whatever she wants to do, whatever she's comfortable with. And she invited friends from high school and college and things like that. So we had, it was here in Madison where we were living, where my family lives. And we also did kind of a whole weekend of events. The other piece of this that we did is that, okay, well, we can stand up in front of friends and family and say we're spending our lives together, but it doesn't change anything legally. But we did, because Madison had recently passed their City of Madison mm-hmm. domestic partnership option, we decided that we would register as domestic partners with the city that same weekend. So we had the ceremony on Saturday. We had to do that Friday because that's when city offices mm-hmm. are open. It was relatively new then. I don't know exactly how new, but this was summer of 94. And we'd also heard from people, don't expect them to say anything like, congratulations, or, you know, they're not going to, you know, bring out flowers or anything like it, when you do a civil marriage, that there is a little, you know, how can we help spruce this up for you? And so we also, as part of the invitation, said, hey, anybody who wants to come along with us to City Hall and say yay, do that. So we did have some friends and family just sort of join us in the office, and, you know, somebody brought flowers, and I don't remember all the details, but it was something where it was a little more festive. So we did that.
How did the city clerks respond to
that? Oh, they were fine. Okay. Yeah, I mean, there was nothing, you know, here or there about it. It was just, it was perfunctory. We signed a form. We wrote a check.
always the check.
Exactly. $25. So we did sort of say, well, we're officially becoming domestic partners with the city. And even though that didn't give us anything immediately, it actually ended up giving us something, in that Ellen is a city employee and she works for the Madison School District now. And so eventually the Madison School District passed a health insurance benefit, and they were the first school district in the country, I believe, to pass it, if that jives with what you've learned about Madison history. So, and I'm on Ellen's dental plan, you know, because she has a dental plan and I don't, through the university. So, you know, we did take advantage of that eventually through that status. But the other thing we did just in our personal lives was, that summer we bought a house together. And we got a joint checking account, and, you know, it was just sort of, I understood the legal aspect of marriage to be more about joint finances and joint property and things like that, I sort of felt like, well, let's have this all kind of go hand in hand. So in a previous relationship, I had been maybe a little too casual and careful about money arrangements with my girlfriend then, and so I was also holding back on joint financial things with Ellen, even though our relationship was really solid. I thought, well, no, not until, you know, the joke is not until I have a ring on my finger kind of thing. You know, it was more of a, I want to make sure we're doing this as a lifelong commitment. This relationship is officially kind of a lifelong commitment before we do joint finances. So we also individually, just in our own lives, in terms of car ownership and home ownership and things like that. The other thing that was happening at the time was just noticing, and that the way businesses or people treated us. So when we bought a car together, having the title in both names, buying the house together, having that established to be in both names, you know, all of the mortgage in both names, all of those things. We did notice that Madison was pretty on top of this, you know, that we didn't run into any, you know, odd glances or questioning, or, you know, everyone's like, okay, you know, it was a non-issue. We didn't know what to expect, and we were pleasantly surprised that it was just a non-issue for everybody we encountered. We did buy matching rings, and that was a non-issue, you know, all of that. And while it feels like a long time ago, this was also just, I think, part of the Madison thing. And I believe I mentioned last week that the businesses we tend to support are the small locally owned types of things anyway. So we didn't go to a big chain jewelry store at the mall. We went to a small locally owned jewelry store in our neighborhood. So to whatever extent that makes a difference, but even just buying outfits, we didn't wear white, we didn't do anything along those lines of dressing ourselves in any kind of traditional wedding type things. We used rainbows as kind of the decorating theme, which now feels a little precious or cliche. I don't know. At the time, it felt like...
Still fairly early.
It was still fairly early. It was a little less cliche.
It was in the 80s, I guess, when the rainbow was adopted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And but we, you know, we made our own invitations. We actually bought the invitations from there. Now I'm going to forget. There was some sort of women's arts and crafts fair in December, along those times that people are trying to sell things. Mm-hmm. And I'm not remembering where or how that was organized, but we went to that. And we actually, there was a woman-owned company from northern Wisconsin that was there that made cards with a quilted design. And we actually contacted them about making invitations for us. So we, you know, we were very specifically trying to support women-owned things or gay or lesbian-owned things in everything we're trying to set up. And we had, I don't know, a couple hundred balloons or something that were at, we actually had the ceremony in my parents' yard, and had just kind of a little pre-reception kind of thing in the house. And so all the balloons were at the house. And then we had a dinner, that we catered through just a local business. The Montes had a catering business then. And again, not gay-owned, but Madison and strong supporters of LGBT stuff in Madison. But it was in a location called Apple Island. Have you heard anyone talk about Apple Island?
Apple Island.
So it was a warehouse space on East Washington, and on the Near East Side, maybe the 600 or 700 block of East Washington, and it was a woman-owned space. Maybe probably lesbian owned, that they were essentially trying to make available for women's events or lesbians' events. So there would be dances held there. This was a time where line dancing was popular, so it was the rise of the line dancing popularity. And so there'd be like line dancing. And, but it was just kind of a wide open space, and they had a sound system. They, you know, but bands could play there, and they rented it out for people. And so we actually rented the space, and caterers came in. You know, so essentially you could use the space any way you wanted. So we just arranged for caterers. We played music on mixtapes on their sound system. We made several tapes of different types of music, and they were all love songs, all women performers, and no mention of men. But there wasn't enough to fill a lot of tapes just of actual lesbian songs, but like Ella Fitzgerald singing songs that were generic love songs. There were no Can't Help Loving That Man. None of those. So anything that didn't actually mention men.
Okay.
And we had a whole tape that was sort of jazz stuff, which we thought would be fun for the reception. Another one that was just sort of fun, you know, maybe dancing kind of thing. There wasn't really a specific dancing time at the reception. But when we left the ceremony at my parents' house, all the guests were told to bring a balloon with them to Apple Island and then tie it to the back of a chair when they got there, because they're helium and they had tall ceilings there. So we essentially moved the decorations that way. And that kind of sums up the ceremony, you know. But the key things were we were making decisions about local businesses and about music and themes and stuff that were somehow women or lesbian focused, as a way to sort of create this event for ourselves. Everybody joked because we kept calling it the thing. Well, we're having this thing. We don't really like calling it a commitment ceremony, but it's kind of like a thing. And so people joked about the thing. We had a scrapbook kind of where people could, we asked people if they wanted to bring pictures of times that they knew us, they could bring that. So people were like, you know, pasting pictures in and writing in this book. And it was, you know, called Carrie Nelson's Thing was that part of the book. So, you know, we just don't, and, you know, we didn't like calling it a wedding. We didn't like calling it a commitment ceremony. So, but we did it, and we're glad we did it. We also have, we have two anniversaries that we recognize regularly, so we recognize the anniversary of that, and then we also recognize our first date anniversary, which is very common, I think, for gay couples to do a first date anniversary.
And that was, of course, at Hotel Wash.
Yes. Our first date was at Hotel Wash. So, but that was something that we noticed a lot of gay couples recognize first date anniversaries, and I don't know as many straight couples who do. They might know it. They might know when the date was, but they don't necessarily go out to dinner or something for that. And I don't know if it's just because gay couples never assume that there'll be a wedding anniversary to recognize. So if that just becomes more common. But
that's an interesting point. No one's ever mentioned that.
So, I mean, we were together for 3.5 years before we had our ceremony. So I never quite, you know, I think of our anniversary really more as being when we first started dating, because that's how long we've been together. Mm-hmm. We were fairly typically lesbian in that we moved in about 4 months later. So we lived together for 3 years. But we had roommates, housemates. So we actually, you know, moved in just the two of us together and bought a house together, accompanying the ceremony at that point of our lives. That's that story.
Well, what kind of then, I guess I would ask maybe just to think then a little bit about the amendment and about the new domestic partnership registry and you know, what maybe how that makes you feel at this point or
what type
of involvements you might have had with those.
Yeah, so, I mean, my feelings evolved over time. When the marriage, same-sex marriage stuff started happening, because as I mentioned, I was not particularly feeling like we need marriage. It was, you know, as long as we're treated equally, I don't care. And, you know, so following the things that came along in Vermont and civil unions, and, you know, so we definitely followed the news on all of the developments, the original stuff in Hawaii that, and Vermont, and I personally got much more emotionally committed to the idea of marriage gradually, and feeling like, no, we ought to be able to get married. That isn't the same. You know, here we did, you know, and feeling like we did this whole thing, you know, this wedding-like thing, and it sure feels like a wedding, and it sure feels like a marriage, but we're not comfortable calling it a wedding, and it's not a marriage, and you know, there are all these things we don't have. You know, we have spent money to have wills written up by lawyers to deal with all the things that wouldn't just happen naturally if one of us were to die for the other person. I mean, we're both in a good situation with our families, and Ellen's family is very open and accepting of me, and there aren't, none of us believes that we would be in that situation, which is unfortunately common for many gay couples, where the family would come in and assert their rights over property or healthcare decisions or things like that. But we still felt the need to have things sort of spelled out in legal documents. I mean, married couples should too. So it's not just, but we felt added pressure that because we didn't have that status. But, you know, I remember hearing a report on NPR about the first day of same-sex marriage in Massachusetts, and it made me cry, and I'm getting a little emotional remembering it too, you know, and so, you know, it is something that's very emotional for me, and I don't know why, I don't know what shifted in terms of why I didn't care initially or what caused me to change, but
Do you think that perhaps your feminist grounding had something to do with it at first?
Perhaps, yeah, that's a good point. It can help me work through my understanding myself. Yeah, actually I do, to some extent. Yeah, because I think if I were straight, and all the same feminist everything that I grew up with, I would have a lot of issues about gender roles in a marriage and things like that. I would definitely, that would be, you know, I would only be able to marry a feminist man. And But yeah, that is quite possibly a part of it. But you know, I also just felt really offended to some extent, although that feels, I mean, maybe that captures a piece of anger, but also hurt, you know, just which is more the emotional thing, to like hear arguments about this, to hear people feel like they have any right to discuss what is, you know, the sanctity of marriage. And I think that was more, it was more hearing the rhetoric of the people, the Defense of Marriage Act and the amendments in the various states as they were being passed, and then ultimately in Wisconsin, where the same thing happened, and knowing that Britney Spears could get married in Las Vegas on a drunken spree, and that would be legal. Yeah. And, you know, my longstanding commitment and shared life with somebody isn't, and how just wrong and unfair that is, and what is the sanctity of marriage anyway, and, you know, all of those types of things. So, you know, it you know, sort of gradually became more and more of an issue for me, where I felt like, no, it's not enough to have a civil union. And, you know, ultimately, I actually think, you know, in terms of general politics, I think, you know, weddings should be whatever you want them to be, and all marriages should be civil. That's ultimately where I came down to. I don't think we'll ever do that. I think our society, in particular in the U.S., is likely to equate weddings and church weddings forever and ever. You know, I don't know that that will ever be separated. But, you know, have your wedding be whatever you want. It can be a church wedding. It can be a civil ceremony. It can be, you know, that the ceremony itself is not the marriage, and that, you know, but all legal statuses are just a civil legal status. You know, it's just something you sign, which it already is, but people don't seem to understand that difference. So it's, you know, that's become more important to me. In Wisconsin, when the amendment was coming up, we were pretty active in fundraising and being vocal and supporting the Fair Wisconsin, which was something,
Action Wisconsin?
Yes, Action Wisconsin when it started, yeah. So we hosted a fundraising house party. It was actually a bingo night. So we did a, I'm forgetting, we had a really clever name. Now it's blanking on our fun bingo name. but we had a big bingo night. We had, you know, and brought together friends and family and colleagues, and it wasn't officially bingo because that's an official gambling something, but it was just a fundraiser where we happened to play bingo. And so that was fun. We hosted a second house party closer to the election. That was a joke party, which we'd done before, where people bring jokes and they write them down and put them in a basket and somebody else pulls them out and reads them. I don't know why, but it seems to be fun. I think we made it up.
And how do you make money off of that?
Oh, we just, people just came and wrote checks. Oh. But they just wrote checks while they were there. And that one, we actually said that whatever we raised that night, Ellen and I would match it. So, you know, we made a substantial donation close to the election. My mom was actually one of the super volunteers with Fair Wisconsin. She was there. She's retired, so she was just there making calls. Mm-hmm. And so it was a big thing, and it was a big blow to have it win. It was a loss, but to have the amendment pass. And as I mentioned the previous time, it did actually was sort of a catalyst for me to think about leaving Wisconsin and take action on that. Because it just really hurt, and that was ultimately what it was about. It was about it hurting. You know, it is something I actually truly believe I'll see same-sex marriage in the country as a whole in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. I don't know when, but I have a feeling that will happen. I basically think we need some people to die off. There do seem to be some generational things. all the surveys of people's attitudes are that the younger generation just thinks it's a non-issue for the most part, in huge, huge numbers and strong percentages.
Even evangelical youth, I think. Yeah.
So, you know, I think someday it will be something of the past. And at our ceremony, actually, we had some readings, and one of them was an editorial piece, I think by Barbara Ehrenreich, about essentially supporting same-sex marriage and civil union rights. I don't remember exactly at the time, because I think at the time most of the dialogue was around civil unions, but, you know, about equality in terms of that kind of thing. And in the article, she mentioned the Loving versus Virginia, I think was the, so the
miscegenation,
the case that ended a state saying that it was okay to ban interracial marriage. And, you know, we actually have an interracial couple that was in attendance at the wedding who, you know, and I think pointing out to people. And at the time, so I think that was a 1967. Mm-hmm. I'm looking to you like you would know all this history, but you might. But and this was 1994. So, you know, it wasn't that long ago, you know, to think 1967, which is within my lifetime, that there was still a state that banned interracial marriage. So I think this will go in that route, you know, that it will eventually happen. And, you know, people now can say, oh, I can't believe that states used to ban interracial marriage. So I think we'll get there. I think, you know, and obviously all the countries everywhere else in the world that are doing this, it says a lot. And Argentina just this month. So it's, you know, it does just seem like the United States is being stupid, and we'll get there. I think we'll get there, unless there really is a major culture war and the right wing ends up winning that. But I don't think that'll happen. I think it'll be a fight, but I'll try to stay hopeful.
Great. Thank you for that. You mentioned games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the games night. I told you about that, Michelle? Or somebody else?
So games night, yes.
Games night. Games night? Games night is, it's just, it started with a couple friends where we realized when we got together, we really just enjoyed playing games, and we would get together with each other. And when we would, we'd be like, let's play cribbage, or let's play, and we have a couple of card games that we like a lot. And every time we did, we enjoyed it. And occasionally among our friends, somebody would have a birthday where they, you know, that would be what we would do, is play games. So it was with another couple, Anne and Anne, as opposed to Anne and Nan, who are another couple on this campus. You know, Anne and Nan. This is Anne and Anne. And when you have Anne and Anne and Anne and Nan all in the same room, it's a lot of fun, let me tell you. But our friends Anne and Anne, we just decided that between us we would kind of host games night as a regular thing. And we used to be much more regularly scheduled, where we would try to set, okay, first and third Fridays, you know, and it, everybody's lives and schedules are too complicated to do that. So we would even try to look at the calendars, like for the semester, and say, okay, during the fall, let's try first and third, and during the spring, we'll do second and fourth, that kind of thing.
When did you start this?
Oh, it's hard to know. It's not that long ago.
Okay.
Maybe 5 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not that long ago. I mean, we've been playing games for years.
Sure. But more formalized.
Maybe 6 or 7 years ago. Okay. Oh, they were still in their apartment. So, yeah, I don't know. But we essentially decided that we wanted it to be spontaneous for people. So we just have this big, long email list, and anybody can be on. It's not exclusive. We, every time we announce a games night, and we alternate hosting. So Ellen and I will host, and then the Ants will host. So whoever's going to host just sends an email out and say, hey, there's going to be a games night, and you can bring a friend, you can bring a game, you don't have to bring a game, you know, you can bring some food, you don't have to bring food, you know. So we usually put out some kind of snacks and have some beverages, and then whoever shows up, often there's more snacks and more beverages overall, but it's, you know, we want it to be as informal as possible, and that nobody should feel like, oh, if I go, I have to bring something, or so we want it to be as open as possible and have people feel comfortable bringing others who we don't know. And so that's the general concept, and we always say you don't have to RSVP, you can just show up. I think the largest we've ever had in terms of actual people who come is something around 17, or, you know, so big enough that you kind of have to have multiple games going in different rooms. Sometimes it's just 5 or 6 people, you know, the 4 of us and 1 or 2 people on top of that, and that's all fine too. And we tend to just kind of decide on a game based on the general mood of the crowd. Sometimes there's kind of a, I just want to sit back in the living room, and we want to do something that's a little more, something where you don't have to be paying close attention to a board, or, and then sometimes we're, you know, playing cards around a table or that kind of thing. And there is kind of a core group of people who regularly attend, and that's maybe 8 or 9 people. And it's always nice when that's shaken up a little, and it's also always nice when it's just everybody you know, and it's, you know, that it's a different kind of comfortable. So it is primarily lesbians, but we're also, I mean, if anything, we worry about not having it seem like it's a lesbian event. So, you know, we want, and it's primarily women, obviously, if they're lesbians, but even if they're non-lesbians, it tends to be women. But we occasionally have had a man show up. He's often token. But we're always like, yay,
and how does that change
being here.
Oh, I was going to say, oh, no. How does that change the sense of community?
Oh, I think it's fine and fun. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's, if anything, we want to make sure that he doesn't feel uncomfortable, but yeah.
We had kind of talked earlier last week about how you maybe weren't so much plugged into the community. Is this maybe a substitution?
We have
creation?
We have a community. I mean, I guess I'm not plugged into the.
I meant earlier on.
Yeah, earlier
life,
on
in your life.
Yeah.
So much. I think we talked about that.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I noticed that, you know, a lot of our friends are lesbians, and I never, you know, and we have a book group that's mostly but not all lesbians, you know, games night is mostly but not quite all lesbians, you know, and you know, not ever wanting to have it seem like that's all I would be comfortable in, you know, it's just, I always feel like, well, it's just how it happens to be, as opposed to seeking out the company of lesbians kind of thing. And it just, I don't know. It's one thing I worry about is somebody feeling, either if they join our book group as a new person, or if they come to games night as a new person and they're either not a woman or not a lesbian, that they would feel uncomfortable or, you know, so I mostly think about it from that point of view. But it's, I have a strong community of friends, I guess. I just think of it that way. I have a strong community of friends. And then they're sort of friends of friends. And you do realize that there are all sorts of groups of friends, and, you know, that, you know, be like, oh, yeah, they're, you know, they're part of the AJ and Holly group. You know, kind of the, and we know people who know that group, but we're not in that group, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, we're certainly aware of other sort of communities of friends in Madison, both, you know, maybe even primarily thinking in terms of the lesbian communities. So, yeah, I don't know. know if that's answering your question.
Well, this did come from Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
That question about, you know, what kind of you think community is, what mm-hmm. it means to you. That's something that, and this isn't my interview, but, mm-hmm. you know, that's something that in my position I certainly experienced a surprising number of youth who are perfectly happy not having straight friends. And that's always surprised me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know to what extent it's comfortable because there is a shared experience. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, we're obviously not automatically friends with all other lesbians.
Right.
You know, so I don't feel like there's a lesbian community in Madison that I'm either part of or not part of, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I mean, there are certainly, you know, groups of people who have been active in different areas or made things happen or worked and, you know, worked on certain issues or things like that. But, you know, I mostly feel like when I stop to ponder the fact that most of my close friends are lesbians, if anything, I worry that I don't want it to be exclusively that, and it isn't, you know, in any way it isn't. And but at the same time, I, you know, it's just kind of like, well, I hope I'm not somebody who would only have lesbian friends. It's just that, but the people I spend most of the time with, kind of the friends you see on a regular basis. And those are the in-person in Madison friends.
That's good.
Goes to the virtual friends.
Yeah.
The much more diverse Facebook friend set. For what that's worth.
Sure. Absolutely. GLSEN.
Mm-hmm.
You've been involved with GLSEN, or as it's now called, GSAFE.
Right.
Now too.
Primarily, Ellen's been involved.
Okay.
So I'm sort of involved via her work.
Okay.
And we have friends who've been involved, friends on the GLSEN, then GLSEN board. Or we've been, because Ellen works at West High, she's a librarian there, she, at some point, quite a while ago now, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, became the GSA advisor
mm-hmm.
at West. And so she's tapped into all of the activities that are organized through GLSEN and now GSAFE, associated with, you know, support of high school students. And, and you know, so I know a fair amount about the experiences of high school students, just, you know, gay and lesbian, high school students, transgender high school students, through her work. And, you know, we've been doing, you know, donating over the years. We attend the big banquet every year. And that, to me, the first year we went, we actually went because one of the aunts, a good friend, was on the board, and she, you know, had a table, and can we mm-hmm. come, kind of thing. And it was so inspiring. You know, I just cry. I go to these GSAFE GLSEN banquets and cry because of the stories. And I still remember the year that a young man from Edgerton won one of the leadership awards, and the Edgerton fire chief and mayor and police, I mean, that they had this table of these Edgerton city officials who came to support him. And, you know, it's just, so you think about our experience in Madison, mm-hmm. and then you think about these little towns elsewhere in Wisconsin. So I think it opens me up to knowing more about the experience of youth elsewhere. And then I also understand from Ellen's experiences, you know, things that go on in Madison schools to some extent. And, you know, Madison West is, because I went there also myself, you know, even when I went to school there, it's never quite been sort of traditional hierarchies of popularity and things at West. You know, there are obviously different groups of people with different perceptions of what that means about them. But, you know, I had good friends in high school who were, you know, smart kids and in orchestra and, you know, sort of things that would usually not make you popular, and who, you know, were being, you know, voted onto the formal dance mm-hmm. courts and things like that, and very genuine, you know, genuinely popular in a very non sort of traditional way. And I was not a genuinely popular person, but I was friends with genuinely popular. but, you know, that, and to some extent, you know, and I was one of the smart kids at West, but there were so many of them that it was not a stigma to be a smart kid. There are so many people in orchestra and choir and theater and stuff that it's just partly because it's a large school, but partly because it's Madison, partly because it's a huge number of kids of professors with University Heights and just sort of a traditional neighborhood thing where a lot of people who work at the university live on the near west side. And you know, I think West is still even somewhat unique among the Madison high schools in terms of, and Ellen's experience, she also worked at Memorial for a year, and she's, you know, in touch with a lot of the other teachers and librarians at other schools, and her feeling is that West is still, you know, not that it's perfect and everybody's fine, but it's still generally an atmosphere of people are allowed to be who they are. And if that means having blue hair, okay, you have blue hair. And if that means being an out gay or lesbian or transgender kid, you know, for the most part, despite, you know, the fact that it's never easy, I think still, especially for adolescents, that it's generally okay. And one story she has about that is a West student who won the leadership award at GSAFE a couple of years ago, who's transgender, and he was actually voted onto one of the formal dance courts, truly, you know, and mm-hmm. as a boy, despite being born a girl, and that, you know, he was actually, you know, quite well-liked by other kids, and that Madison didn't have a problem with that. There was no, like, agonizing over, like, how are we going to deal with this kid being voted onto mm-hmm. this court in this way, you know, that wasn't an issue. And then the wonderful irony was that I guess at the time that they announced the court and stuff, the various couples in the court put on some sort of little skit around some sort of theme. So it wasn't done that way when I was there, but that's what I hear is what they do now. And the theme was Hollywood, and so he and the girl that he was partnered with were going to do a scene from Juno, and that they had a problem with because Juno had this, yeah, teenage pregnancy in it. I was like, here's this ultimate, like, heterosexual issue of teenage pregnancy, and that the principals are getting nervous about, not the fact that it's a transgender kid on the court. So that is both sad and wonderful that they're more concerned about the teenage pregnancy story. So, you know, I'm certainly tapped into some of those things. You know, I think knowing that Ellen can be out as a teacher and librarian at West, and that, I mean, there were times early on when she was working in high schools, and not because of particular incidents, but just in general, I had just sort of worries in the back of my head that, and I was never really concerned about administration being concerned about her being a lesbian, but they're just, you just never know what's going to happen, and you never know what kind of parents or kids might be, you know, cruel, or that she might be in danger in any way. And overall, actually not just generally, but yes, her experience has been just fine being a lesbian teacher.
You thought about that, but you didn't, did you not think about that for yourself in your career here?
It's a good question. Not much. No. I mean, I tend to think of universities as being a little, the only thing that's crossed my mind and I actually raised with our HR director just to make sure that she agreed with my thinking, but The libraries don't have a lot of money. We're libraries. And when we go to conferences, I mean, there's pretty much, you know, it's always cost savings and you never get everything paid for and people always share hotel rooms and things like that. And I mean, so we had been joking and stuff earlier. My colleague, Elliot, who's a gay man, you know, he and I were like, we should be able to share a room at a conference. Why would anyone have a problem with that? You know, so we've talked about the irony of how it would be considered inappropriate for a man and a woman to share a room at a conference, and yet two women can, and nobody seems to care if one's a lesbian, or two men can, and nobody, you know, that nobody's wondering, oh, well, if Elliot's sharing a hotel room with another man at a conference, there'll be hanky-panky going on, or, you know, so we've had conversations among my colleagues about this, but when I became a director, I did sort of ask the question, you know, I postured that I thought it would be inappropriate for me to share a hotel room with a woman who worked for me. So, you know, that, so if there are two women going to this conference, you know, and again, we're always trying to save money, and it, you know, came up for the first time, you know, a few years ago, where one of the librarians I had hired, who worked for me, was the only other woman going to this conference. And before I was director, we wouldn't have thought twice about it. We would have shared a room. And I just thought, you know, that might be, that has the potential to be seen as inappropriate. And so, you know, when that comes up, you know, it's just, and not that we necessarily have the money to pay for two rooms, but I have made the decision that I won't share a room with someone who works for me. So I still share a room with a colleague, you know, like somebody who works at Memorial Library.
Right. Sure.
So, you know, that's, some, I think, the only context in which, and again, it's not like I think there would be a problem. I've never feared that somebody would accuse me of inappropriate behavior or anything. I've never worried about being in my office with a closed door. Or, you know, I mean, I don't think there's any kind of atmosphere here of, you know, homosexuals as predatory. I've never encountered anything that would suggest that that's crossing anybody's mind.
Right.
And I guess this is an employment setting. Right. So.
And I guess high school is perhaps a little different in that
regard.
In
high school, you've got kids. You've got kids under 18, and you've got parents. And yeah, I do think of that as a different setting. And, you know, kids are also at a different stage of development and understanding of the world around them and get confused more easily. And so, not that there aren't confused adults, but it has worried me a little bit. You know, just thinking that there's the potential for something to blow up or blow out of proportion, or, you know, the wrong person getting the wrong idea and deciding to make a case out of it. So.
Great. That was all that I had.
Questions you had?
Did you have anything else you wanted to share?
The one thing that's been sticking in my mind, and this is the interesting thing about doing this over a week, you know, a week in between. So I don't know how much this is part of an oral history or if it's, you know, because I feel like I've learned something about myself just by being asked to articulate something that I haven't done before. And so the thing that's been on my mind since our talk last week was the issue of activism and sort of what my role has or hasn't been, and thinking, I think I said something like, I get on the bus, but I've never organized the bus. And I've never thought of it that way before, but that's been on my mind all week. I was like, is that true? Is that what I do? Is that what I am? You know, so just sort of feeling like I haven't been the one sort of organizing the activism. But I think of myself as politically active, and I think of, you know, I am somebody who shows up, because I know that there are lots of people who don't show up. I show up, I write checks, you know, I do that kind of thing. I you know, I vote, I never don't vote, you know, and I tell people to vote. And I've also never donated to a politician directly. So I've never given Tammy Baldwin a cent. Mm-hmm. And that's more my principle about how politics are funded. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they should be paid for by contributions. Mm-hmm. So, and I feel a little guilty. I feel guilty that I've never given Tammy Baldwin a cent. Oh. But at the same time, that's just sort of a principle I've had. I support you by voting. I'll wear buttons. I'll put signs in my yard. I'll tell my friends I'm voting for this person. This is why. And I think you should vote for this person, too. That's how I provide my support. Mm-hmm. But I do write checks to organizations all the time. And we actually have the Human Rights Campaign mm-hmm. checks. Mm-hmm. So every check I write has the Human Rights Campaign logo and mm-hmm. says working for equality, so things like that. I feel like we actually wrote a check to something. I don't know if it was, I don't even remember what it was, but something where everybody's, it wasn't a political thing. It was like buying t-shirts or something for someone. And whoever took the check was kind of like, wow, that's bold. I'm like, really? It doesn't feel bold, which is sort of, but to me, we had the Human Rights Campaign Visa mm-hmm. until they were bought by whoever who no longer supported it, and then we called and canceled the card and said, this is why we're canceling the card. So we have the Rainbow Visa. People always say, oh, do you get points, kind of thing. I'd be like, no, my card donates money. When I use my card, it donates money. I don't get things. We kind of had both cards and would try to use them equally so we could support both the Rainbow mm-hmm. Foundation and the Human Rights Campaign and, that kind of thing. So, we very much pay attention to where our money goes and who we support and the whole current, mm-hmm. Boycott Target thing that's come up because of what's going on in Minnesota. We pay attention to things like that. We do, tend to stay away from businesses that have history. We own a Subaru. We're actually in our third Subaru. And, even though it's a cliche for a lesbian to own a Subaru, it's also because Subaru's been donating to the LGBT community for 20 years. They gave sponsorship to Martina Navratilova, as an out lesbian, and not many companies did. And, so we do actually vote with our dollars a lot. In terms of businesses we support. So, but I sort of started feeling bad that I'm still not organizing the bus.
Why?
I don't know. I just kind of feel like, am I really an activist if I'm not the one sort of making the things happen? But I get on the bus, so that's better than staying home.
Lots of people don't.
Yeah. So.
The questions certainly weren't intended to make you feel guilty.
No, and it's not that the question was. It was just interesting for me to look back on what I think of. I think of myself as somebody who's been engaged as an activist in some way, but it's always been as a showing up.
That's more important,
perhaps. As opposed to as a making the event that people show up to happen. Yeah. So it was just interesting for me to think back and kind of go back over my life, think back to in my college days and stuff like that, that I was never organizing in action. Mm-hmm. But I've participated in many. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting for me to think about.
And well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, the way being asked questions about the stories of your life caused you to reflect on your life. You articulate things in a way that you hadn't before and mm-hmm. understand things differently. So
good. Well, thank you.
Sure.
I appreciate it very much.